survivor who had no bowel movement for 30 days. By the time the body is through digesting the minuscule amount of food taken in, there simply is very little left to move. I feel no urge to go, but worry about a hemorrhoid that's puffed out. Should my plumbing suddenly blast loose, I may be in for a rupture and hemorrhage, which would be difficult to plug up and heal. I begin modified yoga exercises, twisting, bending, arching, stretching, slowly learning how to balance and compensate for the motion of my waterbed. On the 31st day, the bloody bubble begins to subside, and a small amount of diarrhea relieves my apprehension. Early morning, dusk, and night are the only times that I can coerce my body to exercise. By noon, the temperature has rocketed to 90 degrees or more. It might as well be 900. My body has no water to sweat. The air trapped inside of the raft is humid and stagnant. Staying conscious and tending the solar stills are major struggles. My spinning head coaxes me. Must get up, look around. Slow, easy now, to your knees. I gaze into the lively blue water. Okay, wait now. Maybe a few minutes. I try to get my eyes to focus, but they stumble about in my head, smash into the sides of my skull, and bounce back. Grab the can. Careful not to drop it, already lost one. I dip it down with a gurgle, raise it above me, and let the water fall, massaging my neck and tangled hair with cool relief. Again I dip the can, again and again, imagining that I'm crawling into shaded tall wet grass under a billowing willow tree. Slowly now, lift your head. Look right. Look left. Okay. Up on one leg. Now the other. Stand. Good boy, I say aloud as I sway about in semi-delirium, hoping that I will cool off and my head will clear. The wind flash dries the drops of seawater trickling down my body, escorting tiny streams of heat away. Sometimes the ritual works. I steady up and remain erect for several minutes. Other times, my head feels as if it's being crushed by a heavy weight. My vision fills with swirling bluish haze, and I collapse, using the residue of my senses to guide my fall back into the raft. Yes, I am in much better shape than I thought I'd be by this time. But at high noon, I am often beyond the point of coherent action, as Robertson so dryly puts it. If I can just keep myself together, I can make it to the islands. But how much longer can I hang on like this? Figuring my position time and again, I put myself about 1,000 miles away. Average speed, 25 miles a day. Total passage time, 70 days. If only I can guide myself to Guadeloupe. I've got the raft positioned with a canopy across the wind, and the line astern is just off-center to guide Rubber Ducky 3 a little bit south of west, just as fast as she can waddle. From the Canaries I wrote to my parents and friends, expect me in Antigua around February 24th. That was 7 days ago. Yet I also warned them that the trade winds hadn't filled in yet, so I might arrive as late as March 10th, 7 days hence. If a search is made then, I will still be out of range, way too far out to sea. If only a ship will pick me up soon, those at home won't begin to worry. I see a shark fin zigzagging in quick pumps across Ducky's bow, about 100 feet away. It's a small fin, but I'm still glad that he shows no interest in us. Instead, he slides off to the east, against the wind and current, to await food that is drifting or swimming with the north equatorial stream. Like most predators, sharks cannot afford to be seriously hurt, because an injury or weakness can prevent them from hunting, and may even invite an attack from their own kind. So most sharks bump their prey before attacking. If the prey puts up no defense, the shark will dig right in. They'll eat anything. License plates and anchors have been found in their stomachs. I wonder about life rafts. I count on the bumping to give me a chance to drive them away, but I also think about jaws. I've heard stories of 2 great white sharks caught since that film came out. Both of the real sharks were about the same size as the mechanical prop, 25 feet long and weighing upward of 4 tons. Great whites are an unpredictable species. They're so big and ferocious and powerful that they know no natural enemies and never worry about their prey putting up a significant defense. They give no warning to their attacks, and have been known to smash boats and even attack whales. Then there are orcas, or killer whales, known to have blown large yachts apart. I look at my little aluminum and plastic spear, weighing maybe 1 pound or 2. The point might cause a small shark as much pain as I would feel from a mosquito bite. Even if a small shark forces a showdown at high noon, I'll be pathetically slow to the draw. Boy, I'd love the option to get out of this town. With shivering nights and scorching days, only dusk and dawn offer a little comfort. As the sun drops to the horizon, things begin to cool off. I lounge back again as I did in the morning, flip the sleeping bag over my legs, pump up Ducky's sagging tubes, and watch the sky's grand finale through my picture window. The sharp white disk peeks out now and again from behind the puffy cumulus collected at the horizon. It is past noon in Antigua. If only I had a raft that could sail at a moderate 3 knots, I'd be snug in harbor already. I'll make it anyway. If only I can summon the strength I never knew I had. As the clouds mill about and wander into the sunset, I prepare my dinner, choosing various pieces of fish for a balanced meal, a few chewy sticks which I regard as sausages, an especially prized fatty belly steak, and a piece of backbone bacon with thin strips of brown, crunchy flesh. I crack the backbone apart and drop gelatinous nuggets of fluid from between the vertebrae onto my board. A noodle runs down the spine, and I add it to the gelatin, making a chicken soup. An invisible Jewish mama coaxes me, "Eat, eat! Go ahead, my sick darling! You must eat your chicken soup to get well." Sumptuous tenderloin steaks come from the meaty back above the organ cavity. I choose a couple of fully dried sticks for toast, since they are overcooked and crunchy. The real treats are the organs when I have them. Biting into the stomach and intestines is like chewing on a uniroyal tire, so I don't bother with them. But all else I consume with delight, especially the liver, roe, heart, and eyes. The eyes are amazing, spherical fluid capsules an inch in diameter. Their thin, tough coverings are quite like polystyrene ping-pong balls. My teeth crush out a large squirt of fluid, a chewy dewdrop lens, and a papery, thin, green-skinned cornea. I spend an increasing amount of time thinking about food. Fantasies about an inn restaurant become very detailed. I know how the chairs will be arranged and what the menu will offer. Steaming sherried crab overflows flaky pie shells bedded on rice pilaf and toasted almonds. Fresh muffins puff out of pans. Melted butter drools down the sides of warm, broken bread. The aroma of baking pies and brownies wafts through the air. Chilly mounds of ice cream stand firm in my mind's eye. I try to make the visions melt away, but hunger keeps me awake for hours at night. I am angry with the pain of hunger, but even as I eat, it will not stop. I save the bulk of my water ration for dessert. Since I have rebuilt my stock, I can afford to drink a half pint during the day and 3/4 of a pint at dinner, and still have a couple of ounces for the night. I slowly roll a mouthful around on my tongue until the water is absorbed rather than swallowed. When I return, ice cream will be no more pleasurable. In these moments of peace, deprivation seems a strange sort of gift. I find food in a couple of hours of fishing each day, and I seek shelter in a rubber tent. How unnecessarily complicated my past life seems. For the first time, I clearly see a vast difference between human needs and human wants. Before this voyage, I always had what I needed, food, shelter, clothing, and companionship. Yet I was often dissatisfied when I didn't get everything I wanted, when people didn't meet my expectations, when a goal was thwarted, or when I couldn't acquire some material goody. My plight has given me a strange kind of wealth, the most important kind. I value each moment that is not spent in pain, desperation, hunger, thirst, or loneliness. Even here, there is richness all around me. As I look out of the raft, I see God's face in the smooth waves, His grace in the Dorado swim, feel His breath against my cheek as it sweeps down from the sky. I see that all of creation is made in His image. Yet despite His constant company, I need more. I need more than food and drink. I need to feel the company of other human spirits. I need to find more than a moment of tranquility, faith, and love. A ship. Yes, I still need a ship. The sea has flattened. All is still. Inside of me I feel a symphony of excitement growing, like music that begins very low, almost inaudible, then grows stronger and stronger until the entire audience is swept up in it with a single, synchronized, thumping heartbeat. I rise to scan the horizon. Blowing up from astern are gigantic clumps of cumulonimbus clouds. Rain bursts from their flat, black bottoms, above which thick, snowy fleece billows up to great heights until it is blown off in anvil heads of feathery ice crystals. The clouds push bright blue sky ahead of their walls of gray rain streaking to earth. An invisible paintbrush suddenly splashes a full rainbow of sharply defined color from one horizon to the other. The top of its arc comes directly overhead, lost in turbulent white 10,000 feet up. The breeze caresses my face. The canopy of the raft snaps. The smooth slate sea is broken with white tumbling cracks. The sun suddenly pops out between billowy sky sculptures far to the west and balances on the horizon. It sends warmth tracking to the east upon its path, heats my back, and sets the bright orange canopy aglow. Another invisible brushstroke paints another perfect rainbow inside and behind the first. Between their belts of color are walls of deep gray. The smaller rainbow is a cavernous mouth, well lit on the rim, leading inward to a deeper electric blue. I feel as if I'm passing down the corridor of a heavenly vault of irreproducible grandeur and color. The Dorados leap in very high arcs, as if they are trying to reach the clouds, catching the setting sun on their sparkling skins. I stand comfortably back to the sun as cool rain splashes on my face, fills my cup, and washes me clean. Far away to the north and south, the ends of the rainbows touch the sea. 4 rainbow ends in no pots of gold, but the treasure is mine nonetheless. Perhaps until now I have always looked for the wrong kind of coin. As the spectacle moves on, I empty the captured water into containers, pull the sleeping bag over me, and close my eyes. My body is sore, but I am strangely at peace. For a short while I feel as if I've moved off that seat in hell. The benign routine lasts 3 days. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, nothing lasts forever.
March 6th, day 30. By the night of March 6th, it is blowing like hell again. All night I'm thrown about. It's like trying to sleep in a bumper car. The next day the gale reaches 40 knots. Combers crash down on Rubber Ducky, and I wonder if the strong wind will pick us up and fly us to Antigua. Keeping watch is out of the question. The entrance is lashed down tight. Even tending the still is impossible. If only I had windows, I could see what's going on outside before it leaps inside, and maybe I would see a ship that could get me out of this mess. Patiently waiting for the gale to blow over, I chew on a fish stick. Dorado skin is much too tough to bite through, so I rake the meat off with my teeth. I feel a hard, sharp object in my mouth, like a shard of bone. I fish it out and find that it is plastic. Part of the cap that covers one of my front teeth has been chipped off. When I was young, the cap came off a few times, and I have vivid memories of the stabbing pain that ran down the exposed nerve of the uncapped tooth stub and shot into my brain. I can feel that some of the cap remains over the nerve, but it is loose and can't last much longer. Water dribbles in constantly through the canopy. On March 8th, Ducky is knocked down again. I bail out the gallons of water and begin to wring out the heavy lump that is supposed to be a sleeping bag. My cap is completely gone, but amazingly the tooth doesn't hurt at all. The nerve must have died. Thank heaven for small miracles. I haven't slept for 2 days. My skin is white, and even my wrinkles have wrinkles. My hair sits dripping and tangled on my head. Fish scales cling to me like ornamental slivers of nail polish. With a gap in the middle of my smile, I must be quite a mess, a real hag. Well, we rafties can't be at our charming best all of the time. 2 hours later, Ducky is knocked down again. I sit among the floating debris, exhausted, giving in, no longer able to keep cool. Beating my fist in a splashing tantrum, I yell, "You goddamn son of a bitch, Ocean!" For 5 minutes I do nothing but curse the wind and sea. I break down sobbing. Why me? Why does it have to be me? I just want to go home, that's all. Why can't I just go home? Inside, a second voice scolds me to stop acting like a child, but I'm beyond control. I yell back at myself. I don't give one damn about being reasonable. I'm hurt, hungry, tired, scared. I want to cry. And so I do. What I do not know is that the same day, perhaps at this very moment, my father is calling the U.S. Coast Guard to notify them that Napoleon Solo is overdue. Sometime before, my mother had a nightmare. She had seen me clawing through black waters, struggling to regain the surface. She awoke with a start, sweating, shaking, and had been tense ever since, awaiting word from me. None came. After a few minutes, the fire inside me subsides. I set about the endless, heavy work of bailing and wringing things out. Perhaps when I get back, I will have a picnic with friends and neighbors. Yes, I must return for that. There will be laughter and children and fresh-cut grass, pine trees and trout ponds. I'll have them at last. We will have a brontosaurus of barbecue, trees of salad, and hills of ice cream. People will ask me what it was like. I will tell them I hated it, all of it. There was not one slimy corner that did not stink. You can never love it. You can only do what you must. I hated the sea snapping off shots of heavy rifle fire next to my ear, rolling heavy stones over me, ripping wounds open, beating me, winning. Weeks on end, no bells, no rounds, continued onslaught. I even hated the equipment that saved my life. The primitive raft that was an aimless, drifting pig of a boat. The wretched tent that turned clean water foul. I hated having to catch drinking water in the same box I had to defecate in. I hated having to haul aboard lovely creatures and tear into their flesh like a beast. I hated counting minutes for 32 days. I hated. I did not know a man could have so much hatred and so much longing within him. Yes, I will get home somehow. I must. Has the wind eased a little, or is it my imagination? March 10th, day 34. No, for the next 2 days the gale continues, and life is hellish. I have managed to catch another triggerfish, my third, and another dorado, my fourth. The dorado bent the spear again. I must ration the use of my equipment. Who knows how many dorados it will take to break my spear beyond repair, and how long must the spear last? The distillate collection bag of the solar still was nearly full an hour ago. Now it hangs flaccid. A tiny bird hole has been bitten from one edge of the bag. Friggin' triggerfish. I've lost over 6 ounces of water. That's a half day of life gone, old boy. Won't you feel like a jerk if you die just one half day before being picked up? By March 11th, things have calmed again, and I resume my more placid routine. I'm about halfway to the West Indies. Once again, I have time to count my blessings. Solo stayed afloat long enough for me to salvage what I needed. My equipment is all working, and doing a fair job of it, too. Mountain climbing, camping, Boy Scouts, boat building, sailing and design, and my family's continued encouragement to confront life head-on have all given me enough skill to seastead on this tiny floating island. I am getting there. So far, it is a tale of miracles. March 13th, day 37. On March 13th, however, I'm not feeling too chipper. Because of the bad weather, the last dorado that I caught never dried properly and turned pasty and rancid. I haven't eaten much, and I finally throw it out. I strain to do my yoga exercises, accomplishing in an hour and a half what usually takes only a half hour. Even in the calm of evening, I don't think I can last much longer. Doing just enough to hang on will no longer do. I must keep myself in the best possible shape. I must eat more. I pull in the string farm trailing astern and rake off the barnacles with the blade of my knife. I scrape some rust from the peanut and coffee cans into my drinking water in the hope of absorbing some iron and alleviating anemia. I talk to the lazy vagrant in control of my body. I coax him to kneel by the entrance to await another dorado. At first my body is slow. A dorado swims out. I clumsily splash down. Miss. Another. Miss. But the pumping of blood helps to revive my other self, the physical part. On the third shot, I ram my weapon through the fish's back. It pulls me down over the tube as it twists and jerks to get away. I play the fish as if he's on a light line because I don't want to break or bend my lance. However, I must also retrieve it as quickly as possible before it can escape. So I let it twist and jerk while I reach down and grab the shaft close to the body. Then I lift it up without the risk of bending the shaft. I flip the fish inside onto the sailcloth blanket that protects the floor. When I get the dorado pinned down with my knees, I slip the cutting board under its head just behind the gills, push my knife into the lateral line, and break the spine with a quick twist of the blade. Usually I completely clean the fish before eating, but now I'm very hungry. I simply gut it and place the rest aside. By mid-afternoon, I'm eating the organs, and I feel as if I've had a transfusion. The dorado's stomach seems full of something. I cut it open. 5 partially digested flying fish spill out onto the floor. I hesitate, take a small taste of a flyer, and almost vomit. I gather them up and toss them out. As soon as they are in the air, I think, "Fool! You should have washed them off and then tried them. Next time." But such a waste of 5 fish. I mop up the spilled stomach juices and finish cleaning the Dorado. Sweat pours off my head as I squat over my catch and labor in the heat to slice up the body. I stop twice to stretch out my legs and to relieve my cramped knees and back. The work is hard, but I move fast so that I can rest sooner. I always work that way, pushing myself as hard as I can so I can finish quickly and then find complete rest. As I poke holes through the fish sticks in order to string them up, slam, Rubber Ducky crushes me between her tubes. Water dribbles in and she springs back to her normal shape, as though nothing has happened. It takes me a moment to get my wind back and recover from the shock. The average wave height is only about 3 feet, but a monster leisurely rolls off ahead. I set to work again with a shrug. I'm getting used to various levels of disaster striking with no warning. The still lies lifeless, draped flat over the bow. It must have gotten smacked pretty hard. Air jets out of it almost as quickly as I can blow it in. The cloth across the bottom, which allows excess seawater to drain through, and which is airtight when wet, now sports a hole. The cloth is deteriorated from the constant cycles of wetting and drying, and from chafing against Ducky's tubes. Less than 30 days of use, and the still is gonzo. I've never been able to coerce my remaining still to work. As we have drifted west, the number of light showers has increased, but I am lucky when I can trap 6 or 8 ounces of water within a week. Another critical safety margin has disappeared. I'm in big trouble. Not that I've been out of big trouble for quite a while now. I must get the other still to work and keep it working, perhaps for longer than 30 days. I blow it up until it's tight as a tick. Just below the skirt, through which the lanyard passes, a tiny mouth whistles a single-note tune until the balloon's lungs are emptied. The hole is in a tight corner and on a lumpy seam, which makes it impossible to effectively wedge a piece of repair tape into it. Making something watertight is difficult enough, even for a boat builder in an equipped shop. To make something airtight is an even taller order. For hours I try to think of a way to seal the leaking still. Perhaps I can burn some pieces of plastic from the old still or its packaging and drip the melted globs over the hole. But I find that my matches are sodden and my lighter has been drained of fluid. So I wedge the tape in as firmly as I can and grouchily reinflate the still every half hour. Each time, the still begins to slump as soon as I stop pumping. Water begins to collect in the distillate bag, but it is salty. At this pace, I already feel like I have a case of lockjaw, and my mouth is very dry. I must find an effective solution. If only I had some silicon seal or other kind of good goop. March 16th, day 40. I have managed to last 40 days, but my water stock is declining, and I have but a few hard pieces of fish dangling in the butcher shop. It is also a little disconcerting to realize that Ducky is guaranteed for 40 days of use. If she fails me now, do you suppose I can get my money back? Despite these problems, I have good reason to celebrate this milestone. I've lasted longer than I had dreamed possible in the beginning. I'm over halfway to the Caribbean. Each day, each hardship, each moment of suffering has brought me another small step closer to salvation. The probability of rescue, as well as gear failure, continually increases. I imagine 2 stone-faced poker players throwing chips onto a pile. One player is named Rescue, and the other is Death. The stakes keep getting bigger and bigger. The pile of chips now stands as tall as a man and as big around as a raft. Somebody is going to win soon. The Dorados begin their morning foray. They bang away at the bottom of the raft and sometimes run around the outside, cracking stiff shots against the raft with their tails. I grab my spear and wait. Sometimes I have a little trouble focusing. During the last gale, I jabbed my eye with a piece of polypropylene line I've rigged to keep the still in place. After a couple of days of oozing and swelling, my eye cleared up, but I was left with a spot in my vision, which I often take to be a glimpse of an airplane or the first hint of a fish shooting out before the tip of my spear. Dorados are so fast that my shot must be instantaneous, without thought, like a bolt of lightning. Ahead, a microsecond of hesitation, a splash, a strike, a hard pull on my arm, and an escape. On other days, I've hit two or three, morning and evening, but most of the time come up with nothing. This morning, I'm lucky and catch a nice fat female. Squatting over her for 2 hours on the rolling floor of the raft is hard work for my matchstick legs. Finally, the job is done, and the fish hung up to dry. I begin to mop up the blood and scales, but my sponges have turned to useless little glops. Evidently, the stomach juices that I swabbed up from the last Dorado have digested them. Since my sleeping bag has proved its ability to soak up water, I take out some of the batting and bind this up with pieces of cod line to use as sponges. Each day now I set my priorities based on my continuing analysis of raft condition, body condition, food, and water. Each day at least one factor lags behind what I consider adequate. The dismal problem of collecting or distilling water is one I must find a solution to. I take some of the black cloth wick from the first still, the one that I cut up early in the game. I affix it across the hole of the still with the rotted bottom, letting the still's weight keep it in place. I now have one still aft and one forward, in the only positions available for frequent tending. Every 10 minutes throughout the day, I am a human bellows at the service of one or the other still. In between inflations, I empty the distillate just in case salt water sneaks in to pollute it while I'm not watching. By nightfall, I have collected a full 2 pints of fresh water. I am continually paying higher prices for my small successes. The work is demanding and boils off a lot of body fluid. I can't decide if my steaming cells gain anything from the exercise. There is little time to dream these days, barely enough time to live, but fruit mountains still stand in the panorama of my mind's eye. The next day my debate over the value of operating both stills becomes moot. The entire cloth bottom of the older still gives way. Throughout the day I keep the one still working and try to devise a patch for the old. I painstakingly poke holes around the rim of the opening using my awl, then thread through sail twine and sew on a new cloth bottom. I try to seal it with the bits of tape that I have left, but the patch remains an utter failure. The still lies dead no matter how hard and fast I try to resuscitate it. Luckily, I'm learning about the personality of the new still. The inside black cloth wick is wetted by seawater dripping through a valve on the top of the still. The rate at which the inside wick is wetted is critical to production of fresh water. If it's too wet, it doesn't heat up sufficiently. Instead, the excess warm seawater just passes out through the bottom cloth. If the wick is too dry, there is less than the maximum amount of water available for evaporation. I must maximize the rates at which the water will evaporate, collect on the inside of the plastic balloon, condense, and finally drop into the distillate collection bag. It seems that the inside pressure of the still affects the rate of dripping through the valve. The still seems most efficient at a pressure which allows it to sag, but not so much that the wick hits the plastic balloon, because if that happens, the salt water in the wick is drawn into the distillate. To keep her at just the right inflation requires constant attention. To help prevent another failure of the bottom cloth, I make a diaper for the still out of a square of sailcloth and add padding, using the cloth wicking from the cut-up still. I blanket the bottom of the still by tying the diaper up by its corners to the lanyard skirt, hoping the diaper will take the chafe from Ducky and will keep the bottom cloth constantly wet to delay rotting. My rain collection system also needs improvement. At the first thrap of water droplets from the sky, I usually wedge the Tupperware box against the aft side of the still. It's held in place by the still bridle. The arrangement is simple and is quick to rig or empty, which is important in order to minimize salt water pollution from breaking waves and spray. However, I think that I can catch more water if I can find a way to mount the Tupperware box on top of the raft. I need to put a bridle around the box so that I have something to secure it with. The awl on my jackknife has a cutting edge, so I wind it into the plastic lip that runs around the box, boring a hole in each corner. Through these I string a collar made of sail twine. I secure the two ends of one bridle to Ducky's tail, lead the middle of it to the top of the arch tube, and equip it with a quick-release metal clip that I've stolen from one of the stills. Forward, I tie a short lanyard to the canopy entrance and affix a second clip to the other end, which I also lead to the peak of the canopy. When I have to use the Tupperware for some other purpose, I leave the two clips hooked together so that they are always ready. As soon as it begins to rain, I can quickly flip the clips onto the collar of the box, which keeps it pretty secure on the apex of the arch tube, angled more directly into the wind and higher away from the waves. Its biggest benefit is that it is no longer blanketed from rainfall by the canopy, which is now below it. In fact, it will prove twice as effective this way. Finally, I must tend to my steel knives. My Cub Scout jackknife with the awl is one that I found when I was 12. The spring on its main blade has always been broken, so the blade flops about a little. It's a ball of rust now. I scrape it clean. I sharpen both it and my sheath knife frequently. Rubbing the steel hard against fish skin that has a tissue of fat attached produces a tiny drool of fat, which greases the blades until they shine. I treasure raw materials and basic tools. So much can be done with them. Paper, rope, and knives have always been my favorite human inventions, and now all three are essential to my own sanity and survival. March 18th, Day 42. Each day seems longer. On my 42nd in the raft, the sea is as flat and hot as an equatorial tin roof in August. The sun in the sky is joined by hundreds that flash from the water ripples. It is all I can do to try to move about in Ducky. We sit like a period in a book of blank pages. I find that my sleeping bag helps to keep me cool as well as warm. I spread it out over the floor to dry in the sun. When I stick my legs under it, they are shaded and sandwiched between the wet bag and the cool, damp floor. It is not very good for my sores, but they are not too bad now, and the relief from the heat is quite noticeable. Without the bag covering, the black floor becomes very hot, and the whole inside of Ducky, which is hot enough as is, becomes an unbearable oven. Nothing to do but wait for the wind and try to score more food. Some good fresh gut should help lift my spirits. Triggers, a school of them, flap up toward the side of the raft, then disappear under it, come up again, pirouette, dive, loop, and roll about each other in an amazing underwater ballet. They are very wary of me now and are becoming more difficult to catch than the Dorados. They don't have the same sustained speed, but in quick little jerks they can dodge my spear deftly. They flirt just outside my reach, jab, miss. I must two-arm a hit on a Dorado, but maybe I can get a quick and penetrating one-arm shot on a trigger. Jab, jab. Their waving fins taunt me. My arm snaps out straight. A trigger takes the spear in his belly. Inside the fish, I find large white sacks, must be the male organs, that I will soon treasure as much as the female's golden eggs. Ducky, can't you please stop flopping about? You're bound to be sending out a general invitation to every shark in the district. Maybe I should get more fish while things are so flat. The sun sinks down to the horizon once again, and the Dorados collect for evening recess. They seem mesmerized by the calm conditions and glide about like phantoms, gently nudging us. The Emerald Elders still skirt the vicinity, keeping an eye on their school. I am coming to know individuals, not only by their size, markings, and scars, but also by their personalities. I am getting very attached to them. Some like to strike one side of the raft, while others prefer another. Some strike aggressively and quickly fly away, as if they are angry or are testing my strength. Others softly glide along the bottom and wiggle out, right in front. Fire! I hit too far aft, near the tail. She churns the surface and shakes loose. I rest. Clouds sit like dirty fingerprints across a silver sun that reaches down to touch the horizon. Bands of light, Jesus rays, strike out across the heavens. On the eastern horizon, the sky has reached a deep blue, soon to be black and filled with twinkling stars. The soft round waves remind me of long stretches of ripe wheat fields. Bending to a gentle breeze that marks where invisible heavens touch the earth, the heavy-headed stalks bow their heads and await the reaper's scythe. I haven't much time to fish. I take up my pose again. A big form appears to my left. By now I'm used to awaiting the perfect shot, but I may not get another this evening. What the hell? Without thinking, without fear of battle with another male, I roll to the right and jab the spear to the left. Humph! Solid hit. All is still. Where's the fury? I'm grasping the gun tightly, leaning over the tubes, frozen. In a second the battle will begin. But it doesn't. In his huge head, the eye is glazed. His slightly opened mouth is paralyzed. His gills are glued shut. The tip of the spear rests in the stripe that runs down his side, which marks the position of his spine. The barb is still barely visible. The spear has not been driven straight through. I gently pull him toward me, grab the spear with my other hand, and ever so carefully begin to lift. It's like juggling a ball on the end of a stick. What a relief not to endure another dangerous battle. He's food for a week. The glassy surface bubbles up as his body begins to rise. Taking the weight now. Splash! I lunge to grab him, too late. His smooth skin slips from my fumbling fingers. The big, stiff body whirls downward, like a bright dead leaf falling from a limb. His blank stare goes round and round as he sinks deeper and deeper. All of the other Dorados have been watching. Like fingers reaching down to him, they descend. Deeper, still deeper. Finally, their shapes converge like living petals blooming from the stamen of the dead fish. The tiny flower whirls ever deeper, getting smaller and smaller until it is no more. The sun is gone. The waters become black and empty. I stare into the depths.
6. Cries and Whispers. On March 9th, the New York Coast Guard instructed stations in Virginia and Puerto Rico to broadcast the standard yacht overdue message on their offshore Notice to Mariners, which is usually monitored by commercial and pleasure craft venturing in deep waters. Through Lloyd's of London, the guard traced me to the Canaries. Since there was no official record that I was ever on Hierro, they refused to believe that I left the island at the end of January. Only when my mother and father give them a copy of my letter, postmarked on Hierro, do they believe my parents are correct. This kind of mistrust of emotionally involved amateurs in the search and rescue business will characterize their handling of my case and will lead to some bureaucratic embarrassment. The Coast Guard next conducts a harbor check in the West Indies to see if Napoleon Solo has arrived without notification. No one knows exactly when I left the Canaries, or whether I took a direct route, swung south to catch the trades, or sailed via the Cape Verde Islands. My family knows I did not take the Cape Verde route, but the guard cannot be certain. The ocean is an unbelievably vast wilderness. Pinpointing a vessel, even when its approximate position is known, is literally more difficult than finding a needle in a haystack. Even if my position could be approximated within 100 miles, a circular area 200 miles across, covering over 30,000 square miles, would have to be searched in order to locate me. What the Coast Guard does not tell my family is that if I am more than a week overdue, I am most likely dead. It happens all the time. 374 sailors died in U.S. waters between 1972 and 1977 in commercial fishing accidents alone. Coast Guard funding has been cut, so they are understaffed and under-equipped. Besides, even if they send out a search party, they won't find me. I am still so far out to sea that I am out of range of an effective search. The guard tells my family that sending aircraft to look for Napoleon Solo is out of the question. Meanwhile, back in my raft, though I still scan the sky for any sign of a plane, I am painfully aware of the improbability of seeing one. By March 18th, my 42nd day in the raft, the Coast Guard has finished the harbor check, which is concentrated on the French and English West Indies. No one has seen Solo. Each night I sleep for about an hour and a half at a time before a clump of hair is pulled out by Ducky's rubber, or cramps in my legs deepen to the point that I must move. I get up, look around, and lie down again in one of the other two semi-comfortable positions. The moon has been bitten away to nothing, grown round and fat again, and is now being devoured a second time through the endless progression of nights. Despite my worries, especially about sudden terminal damage to my raft by sharks or other creatures, all is holding together, and I feel well rested. I arise on March 19th as usual, hoping that this day will hold the key to my release. March 19th, Day 43. I cannot stop mourning the big Dorado that I futilely slew last evening. I try to convince myself that my depression comes only from the fact that I am in desperate need of meat, but my sense of loss is not solely pragmatic. Ineffectual attempts to catch fish are nothing new,
and I think little of them. I feel emotionally devastated. The Dorados have become much more than food to me. They are even more than pets. I look upon them as equals, in many ways my superiors. Their flesh keeps me alive. Their spirits keep me company. Their attacks and their resistance to the hunt make them worthy opponents, as well as friends. I am thankful for their meat and companionship, and fearful of their power. I wonder if my deep respect for them is related to my Indian ancestors' respect for all natural forces. It is strange how killing animals can sometimes inspire such worship of them. I can justify killing the Dorados in order to save my own life, but even that is getting more difficult. Last night's killing was to no one's advantage. I have robbed the fish of life and myself of the fish's spirit. I feel as if I have gravely sinned, that this is a very bad omen. Such waste. How I hate waste. Still, I realize that if I am to survive, I must continue to fish. I must prepare myself to kill again this morning. A large plastic loop is riveted onto the tip of the aluminum tubing of my spear gun. The arrow used to shoot through the loop, but now lies tightly bound through it. I detect a crack in the plastic. The fitting is near the end of its life. If the fitting breaks, the slender silver arrow might be twisted off and pulled out. If I lose it, I'll have nothing with which to fish. I add some lashings to further secure the arrow shaft to the plastic tip, and the plastic tip to the aluminum tubing. It looks ridiculously secure, but I know that the whole rig is tenuous at best. I wonder how many more Dorados it will last. The fish begin their gala morning procession. A head appears directly under my point. I thrust down and drive clear through the body, which immediately becomes a somersaulting monster, practically whipping the gun from my grip. I hold. No! The plastic gun tip explodes. Lashings fly apart and tangle in the air. The arrow's metal butt is snapped cleanly off, and the arrow is torn off the gun shaft. I dive forward, trying to grab the spear, but it flips forward with a splash. A horrendous sound like a ripping open of a huge stiff zipper meets my ears. The Dorado has run the sharp tip into the bottom tube of the raft. Air blows out in a spluttering, heinous burble. The fish is free. Somehow I've managed to keep the gun and spear in my hands. I cast them inside and grab hold of the tear. Oh my God, it's a gaping hole, a mouth about 4 inches long. I try to roll the lips together, but Ducky continues to sink. Huge bubbles explode from the opening, then smaller bubbles, rolling out more slowly. Finally, the bottom tube lies flat and still. It is over. Rubber Ducky is settled so that she is supported by her top tube. There are now about 3 inches of freeboard. Waves slosh in over the top. Water pressure under the raft pushes the floor upward. The pressure yanks the bottom tube from my grasp and pulls it under, giving the floor enough extra material to bulge up to sea level. I struggle to move through the rubber quicksand, trying to locate my equipment, which has been swallowed up. If I cannot repair the damage, I will not last long. It will be impossible to stay dry, and salt water sores will bore into my skin. My legs stick into the sea. Now, passing sharks will grab these rather than the ballast pockets. The fish already batter and bite my limbs through the rubber. I won't be able to sleep. My legs hang down so deeply that when the Dorados bump, they will be well below the range of my spear. Even if I do catch fish, I won't be able to dry it, and it will soon turn to inedible muck. Ducky is wobbling more than ever, and that will increase chafing on the still. I must do something, and do it quickly while the weather holds. The conical plugs from the repair kit are much too small to stop up the tear. Perhaps a piece of foam from the small cushion that I got out of Solo will work. Fortunately, it is closed-cell foam, made of billions of tiny bubbles, rather than open-cell, which is made of similar bubbles but with burst walls. Closed-cell foam doesn't absorb water and is airtight as well. Ignoring the Dorado's beatings, I find my tools and set to work as fast as I can. I cut a strip of foam and several pieces of light line, lean over the bow, and pull at the bottom tube against the weight of my equipment and myself. The tear is close enough to open it up, but still out of sight. I stuff the foam plug in, grab the top and bottom lip, lasso them with the line, and tightly wind the line around.
The line hasn't caught the outside edges of the mouth, so I add more line, trying to work it inboard of the first line. The windings pull the mouth into enough of a pucker to enclose its edges. The patch pokes out like flounder lips with a little foam tongue hanging out. Time to try it out. The pump whimpers. The tube begins to bloat, pulling the floor a little tighter. As Ducky begins to rise, the underwater gurgling breaks the surface, and the mouth rears up and hisses at me like a sea serpent. Within 15 minutes, the tube is soft again, and my body sinks into the rubber quicksand. I lean back over the side. Air is escaping from the numerous wrinkles in the material, which spread from the puckered tear like roots from a tree trunk. I test batting from the sleeping bag to use as caulking, but even when densely compressed, air flows through it. My old gloppy sponges may be effective if I cover them with collars of foam strips. For 5 hours, I try to fill the gaps in the seal. Each time I pump up the tube, a trickle of bubbles breaks the surface. I push in more caulking, but the bubbles multiply and grow larger. To keep the tube tolerably inflated requires 50 pumps every half hour. 3,000 pumps will be needed each day to keep Rubber Ducky 3 alive. That's over 2 hours of grueling exercise, about twice what I think my body can manage. When the seas rebuild, if the patch holds at all, I'll probably have to double my efforts. It's impossible. We're about 600 miles out to sea, 34 days from landfall at best. The deflated bottom tube is acting like a sea anchor, slowing Ducky's drift. Working hard in the intense heat, my mouth salty from holding the line and knife between my teeth, I have reached a new, desperate level of thirst. My muscles are already spent. I'll never last 34 days. Lying back, I feel the tube deflate once again. I try to rest and stay calm. Perhaps there is a shipping lane between Brazil and the southern coast of the United States, about 300 miles away. Still too far. I feel as if I've been taken off my seat in hell, only to be thrown into the fire. My mind wanders to the many repair devices that might be effective. Needle, sail twine, and good goop. A huge hemostat type of scissors vise, maybe a balloon that could be inserted and blown up. But such materials are to be found only 120 leagues to the west. The only solution I can think of is to push a plug into the hole and lash it up tight. How I miss the inspirational advice and hope, the ingenuity, creativity, and charity of a helping hand. A bank of clouds slides by to the north. I must beat the weather. A sliver of moon sits in a very black sky, like a dreamy eye open just enough to watch the sleeping sea. I tie my flashlight tightly to the top of my head, like a makeshift miner's helmet. All of the equipment is secured to the windward side to keep it from tumbling down on me. Pre-cut light line laces hang from the fish strings within easy one-arm reach. With my nose to the water, I can just see the damaged area. I don't much like reaching down into the blackness. Slowly I work loose and remove the rat's nest of lines and plug. The beam of light shines down upon the still waters and catches small fish yards below. From how deep can the beacon be seen? Will it attract fish? I begin to reinsert the plug. The beam is suddenly eclipsed by a huge gray shape sliding by just inches from my hands. I jerk them from the water. The shark is about 10 feet long, average. He lazily swings around the raft, breaks the surface for a moment, and then resubmerges. I thrust at him several times with a spear, but it is like trying to move a mountain with a toothpick. He lazily mops his tail this way and that, as if he doesn't even feel the point. I do not see him for some time. Now the awakened eye of the moon is higher and brighter. I bend to work again, forcing the plug deep into the tear, carefully cinching it with the line, winding, pulling hard, winding, sharp teeth, my hands catapult from the water. Adrenaline must be oozing from my quaking skin. I flip the flashlight back on. A triggerfish whirls about the patch and disappears. My watch, of course, the glowing hands and numerals. The trigger must have thought it was edible. I take it off and again dip into the ocean. The bottom tube has to be completely deflated. Then I can pull a sufficient amount of material up around the plug and lash it into a big enough pucker that the line can catch the outside corners of the mouth. An effective plug will shorten the outside circumference of the raft by 4 or more inches. When the cheeks behind the mouth inflate,
they will try to stretch it back out to its original shape and stretch the mouth out flat. 2.5 pounds per square inch is the pressure that must be resisted. Using my forearm as a lever and the top tube as a fulcrum, I pull the lashing so tight the lines cut my hands and the top tube rubs so harshly against my forearm lever that it chases a large hole through the skin. It's still no good. The patch leaks almost as fast as I can pump it up. I'm so exhausted that I fall asleep, rolling around in my soggy ship.
March 20th, day 44. I awake at dawn, ready for another try. As I expected, when the bottom tube is inflated, the lips are pulled out flat enough for a corner to slip out from under the lashings. Bubbles snigger out from the side. I stuff shards of foam and balls of gooey sponge into the crevice and tie it to the main plug. A gray hulk with white-tipped fins slips under me. The damned water buzzard is still here, lolling about, biding his time, circling, waiting. I have retied my spear together, being very careful to make it tight enough that I can neither pull the arrow out nor loosen the lashings. It's a pretty stiff rig. I jab at the shark when I can, but he banks and swoops, gliding just out of range. When I do strike, he ignores my puny stings. I continue my work. I fit a collar of foam around the primary and secondary plugs and pump up. Air bubbles stream out from every wrinkle of the dentureless mouth. 60 pumps each half hour, or my legs will poke down like sausages, free for the tasting. I'm getting angry. The beast comes in close. I wait for him, hatred screwing up my face. I rise as high as I can and ram the spear down with all my weight, making a dead center hit on the lateral line that runs down the side of his head and back. This line is so sensitive it can pick up the vibrations of a struggling wounded fish over a quarter mile away. Within a second he has disappeared, shooting through the depths like a Millennium Falcon from Star Wars jumping to hyperspace. I tie a line from the boarding ladder anchor loop across the patch up to the hand line. By pulling on the line, I can put enough outside pressure on the patch that the leak significantly slows. I add a couple of tourniquets as well. At last, Ducky requires only 40 pumps every 2 hours, but I hear the constant hissing of the angry serpent looking for any escape route. Work is burning up the aching muscle tissue in my arms, but there is no rest for the wicked. I must get the still working again and build up my strength. There's no dried fish left. When the Dorados come to visit between hunting forays, I am ready. I double-check my spear lashings and get into position. It is all I can do to strike my pose, not to mention a fish. Clumsy, inaccurate, anxious stabs succeed only in thrashing the water and scaring them off. At last one comes within range. Groaning, I drive the shaft down, strike her in the back, but do not get all the way through. She spirals about the end of the arrow at incredible speed, and in a moment, before I can grasp my weapon with both hands, she is gone. I look dumbfoundedly at the blunt threaded tip of the spear. In less than 2 seconds, the fish neatly unscrewed the point and left with it. The Dorados have awaited their chance to test me. They have destroyed my ship, disarmed me, and now they mock me. If only I were a sea creature. Fish do not get themselves into problems that they must use intellect and tools to solve. They simply swim, breed, and die. I am awed by the intricate perfection of the world in which I find myself, but I am too tired for true appreciation. Instead, I collapse, depressed. I cannot lift my arms easily, but I must. Now there is more work to do than ever. I begin to dig through my equipment bag, looking for anything from which to fashion a new point for the spear. In one of the pockets I find a Boy Scout utensil kit, made of flat sheet stainless steel, a knife, fork, and spoon nested together. It's another item that I had kicking around for years and threw into my emergency bag because I had little other need for it. I can try to make a point from either the fork or the knife. The fork is sturdiest and may be useful for pronging triggerfish. I decide to try the knife first. Again, I use cod line for the lashings, winding them as tightly as possible around the knife handle and the arrow shaft. The knife has 2 holes in it. I tie a string from the aft hole back to the line that retains the arrow, and then further back to the gun handle. Even if the knife is pulled off the end, I won't lose it. The thin blade sticks out several inches forward of the arrow shaft, It feels very wiggly, and I can easily bend it, so I have my doubts about its effectiveness in catching Dorados. I'll try it on a triggerfish first. Even the trigger's tough hide will probably bend the tip over, but they stand off anyway, as if they know I'm rearmed. Perhaps it's time to try the hook and line again. Gooseneck barnacles make good bait, and they're plentiful enough. I pull up the line that trails astern to the man overboard pole, scrape off a couple of fat barnacles, slip one on a trout-sized hook, and trail it astern. Within an hour I have a fish on the line. Great. Maybe I can live off a triggerfish. When I reel in my catch, it suddenly blows up like a balloon, brandishing hundreds of sharp spines. Porcupine fish are notoriously poisonous, and the spines are another threat to poor rubber ducky. I shake the hook free and try again. The puffer goes at it again. No one else is interested. To hell with it. Strange wildlife begins to show. Shrill squeaking comes from the water under the raft. Saddleback porpoises appear, keeping their distance. Light and dark streaks mark the stirrups and seats that give them their name. They somersault over one another and move off, leaving behind a touch of their smiling-faced spirits. A fish, longer and slimmer and less colorful than a Dorado, whips past. It's too fast and far away to identify clearly. Clumps of sargasso appear more frequently and take on signs of age which they lacked further east. They have had time to develop their own ecosystem. Clear eggs sprinkle the branches, many of which are dead, like dewdrops in a graying beard. While I pick out the eggs, a couple of crabs, about a half inch across and sporting white graphics on their backs, scurry away. One tunnels through the weed, drops out onto the waves, and swims away like a water bug. The other I grab and pop into my mouth like an M&M. The tiny morsel of crab meat is a welcome relief from the taste of fish. Ducky drifts over transparent globes of phytoplankton, about an eighth to a quarter inch across. I've seen them on occasion since the beginning of the voyage, but as we drift westward, they have collected into thick clumps, and many are always in view. If I had packed nylon stockings into my equipment bag, I could have made plankton nets, which I would trail at night when the large zooplankton orbit to the surface, glowing with phosphorescence. But without an efficient collection system, the tidbits I reap from the weed and waves are far too scant to live on. I lie back and gaze up into the sky, the only thing I share with those back on dry land. A snowy white bird with two long feathers streaming from its tail and a Lone Ranger black mask across its eyes flaps wildly about, squawking. I've often watched tropic birds try for hours to perch on top of a pitching mast. I hope that this one is silly enough to land on Rubber Ducky 3. After a while, the bird flutters on its reckless way in a vague northerly direction. Each change in wildlife or weed is a sign. Each heralds altering currents in progress west. Am I closer to the continental shelf than I thought? No, that's just plain wishful thinking, you turkey. My own whimpering accompanies the pumps as I continue the struggle to keep Ducky inflated. I'll hang on as long as I can. Then I'll turn on the EPIRB one last time and hope that I'm in range of western flights and that the battery has more juice than I do. Dougal Robertson's book contains several useful charts. One marks the migration routes of birds. Another shows expected rainfall, not much for my area. Another the major shipping lanes. My large chart also shows the lanes, as well as currents, winds, and other details. I transfer the outline of the continental shelf from one of Robertson's charts onto my large chart, though the scale of the small charts may be quite inaccurate. None of the charts shows any shipping from South to North America, but I reason there must be a large number of small vessels running an inter-island business in the Caribbean, and there should be traffic from Brazil to islands and to other points north.